Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me and before I be a slave. I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Oh, freedom.
This is Anissa Abdel-Fattah, and our show is called The Proverbial Fan. And the reason I chose that name is because I imagine that by time anything of significance, any type of information, news, or anything gets to this point, we'll disseminate it, inshallah. So just like if you throw something into the fan will blow it all around. That's what our program is going to be about each Saturday, inshallah, that we will look for topics that are interesting, news, whatever it is, and that we will try to disseminate it from here. This is kind of the last line of defense in public information, the alternative media on the smallest level you can get from home. So anyway, the reason I put this program together today is because, like most of you, I've been watching what's going on right now in Palestine. And I think that it's fair to say, without seeming to take what's going over there too lightly, I think it's fair to say that the young people who are leading this, what they're calling the Al-Aqsa or the Jerusalem Intifada, are a real inspiration for all of us. I think that the way they are approaching this Intifada is sending a message, you know, throughout the entire world that people are just, you know, fed up. You have 25 years of so-called peace process negotiations and you lose more than what you started with. You've had three assaults that turned into massacres where over, 1,500, 2,000 people are killed for absolutely no reason. There's no strategic or any other kind of benefit in the slaughters that Israel carries out routinely in Gaza. But they do it, and we know the reason that they do it. They say it's for deterrence and because they're going to wipe out Hamas. But actually, we all know that what they're doing is a genocide and ethnically cleansing Palestine because Israel intends to expand. And that's no longer a conspiracy theory or a mystery. We'll follow what's going on in the Arab Muslim world right now. Understand that it's a very aggressive Israeli expansion, or we'll say Zionist, because the Israelis are the only ones involved in it, expansion program that is, covering pretty much the entire Arab Muslim world. And I guess Palestine is the hottest spot. An ongoing occupation, 60 years of massacres, oppression, apartheid. You know, when you think about it, it's mind-blowing. It's staggering. You think about the number of people that have had to have been, just killed for no reason except that they were not Jewish and that they were Palestinian. And we kind of get the understanding of what's in store for the rest of the Arab Muslim world if the Palestinian people lose this bid for their freedom. So anyway, I was thinking when I decided to put the program together, I was trying to decide what is it that we can talk about, because I knew I wanted to talk about the Intifada, but I didn't know what my approach was going to be. So I tried to figure out, well, what is probably the thing that's being most neglected, that hasn't been said, that needs to be talked about. And I came to the conclusion that, it might do us some good to talk about the lack of energy that we are sending, or the energy that we could, the potential that we have to really energize the Intifada, from abroad, from where we are. I'm in the United States. I know lots of my friends are from different areas of the world, and probably like me are all wondering, what can we do? What could we do to help? It's not enough just to sit and, cruise the net looking for tidbits of information, trying to somehow wrap our minds around, what's going on every day, seeing the young men of Palestine being shot and killed, the IOF dropping knives as a pretense to shoot and kill people. It's not enough just to know that stuff. In fact, if you know that kind of stuff and you don't really have any way to process it, to move it forward towards some end game that is positive, then it can really become very frustrating and even depressing. So I thought it'd be worthwhile, perhaps for us as well as for the Palestinian people, for us to give a little thought to what we can do from where we are to help. And I listed a few things that I think are inhibiting us from doing more. I know there have been some marches in solidarity, but I didn't see like any really huge marches, the kind of marches that we had when the assault was going on against Gaza in 2012. We haven't really seen the type of outrage that we saw even with the Israeli assault on Gaza in 2014. But we have seen some marches. We have had people speaking out. I think today we even had the EU issue a statement saying that Israel is carrying out field executions against Palestinians and using disproportionate force, which is big. That's big coming from the EU. But I don't think it really does a lot to show the young men and women on the ground in Palestine that we're with them and that we support what they're doing. And I think that's what they need. They need to be able to know somehow that the people of the world, the real people of the world, support them, are inspired by them, and are with them and really want to help them. But we just have to figure out what is the best way to go about that. So anyway, I listed a few things. I asked myself, well, what's preventing the kind of response that we would expect to see to an event like this Intifada? I mean, let's remember the kinds of things that were happening in Palestine leading up to the beginning of this Intifada in October. Israel was preparing for a major assault, either in the West Bank or Gaza. How do we know? Because they're so predictable. They were escalating, killing 1, 2 to 3 Palestinians per day, per week, demolishing more homes, acting very aggressive and provocative, and carrying out activities at the Al-Aqsa Mosque that they knew, they had to know, was going to provoke some type of a response from the Palestinians. But I don't think they got the response that they expected. I think they expected that the Islamic Resistance was going to carry out some type of an operation close to Al-Aqsa or near Al-Aqsa or somewhere to send Israel the message that there would be a response to their provocations and destruction and desecration of the mosque. But the people who responded wasn't the resistance. The young men, the people I call the young lions of Palestine who responded, civilians, who acted impromptu in response to this provocation, these murders, this escalation and oppression, a very natural response that left Israel with its mouth open because it couldn't claim that it was going to wipe out Hamas. These young lions, I think, this is my opinion, saved Palestine from something much worse than we have seen to date in respect to this Intifada, because in my opinion, Israel was gearing up to do something very serious, very ugly, and very bloody in Palestine. But because rather than the armed resistance responding to Israel's provocations, the people of Palestine themselves did it. And they did it mostly with slingshots and stones. I know the knifings are taking place, and the knifings are important. I'm sorry to say that. I know people will say, oh, Anissa, how could you support knifings? I support knifings because I don't like burnings, and I don't like burning kids alive and kidnapping them and setting families' homes on fire and burning everybody in the house alive. I don't like Israeli settlers walking the streets with fully automatic machine guns, kidnapping and hanging bus drivers and, you know, you get tired of that after a while. And even though, you know, we're accustomed to playing down the horrible nature of the kinds of crimes that the Israelis commit against the Palestinians, we have to admit that as of late, they have been pretty heinous and they can't be ignored. So if you don't want the armed resistance carrying out armed assaults against settlers, then the only thing, the only alternative to that is to recognize the right of the Palestinian people to defend themselves. And if all they have is knives, oh well, I would rather see them with fully automatic weapons. But unfortunately, that's not up to me. So anyway, going back to this list that I made, trying to figure out or trying to list some of the things I think are inhibiting the type of response we would expect, or at least that I had expected to see, to the Intifada, not, you know, seeking to diminish the importance or impact of any of the demonstrations or statements or anything that has taken place to date. I am not doing that. I'm just saying that we can do more and that I had expected to see more. So anyway, I'm thinking that some of the things that are inhibiting a better or more robust response to the Palestinian Al-Aqsa Intifada are, and these are listed in according to priority. I think the most important thing is that lots of the European governments, and we see in the United States, we see small demonstrations in response to things that happen in Palestine. But because the United States is so heavily controlled and dominated by the Zionist media, it's very hard here in the United States to do an action that would even be covered by the media. We could have 10 billion people in the street, just like we did right before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And if the media doesn't agree with what you're doing, they simply ignore it, you know, and they go on to the cooking shows or the, you know, next false flag, mass murder, where they can indict Muslims, you know, the things that interest them. So I think, and that, you know, wasn't on my list. It should have been on my list, but it wasn't. But anyway, since I'm talking about that now, let me go ahead and say that I think that one of the things that discourages Muslims in the United States is that there's no way to appeal to our media to get the coverage that would cause the effect that, of course, a mass demonstration is looking for. We wouldn't be, you know, unless the international media was to cover these events, it might be projected out into the rest of the world in some places, but it certainly wouldn't have much of an effect here in the United States. And I think that discourages a lot of people here in the United States from wanting to do anything, you know, bigger. And I also think that people here in the United States are afraid, not because we've had any of the kind of incidents like comparison, you know, to Paris or Tunisia or anything like that, but we have lots of rumors, lots of murmurings, particularly in the alternative media, about government planned responses to large demonstrations that are opposing anything that our government, that is part of our government's agenda or our foreign policy. So, of course, we know that our government offers unconditional support to Israel, and they don't really want to see any very loud and big demonstrations in support of Palestine, and particularly not in support of the Intifada. That's an assumption. So I'm thinking that in the United States, we have lots of people that are afraid to do very much because of these rumors and allegations that the government put snipers on the buildings, they put provocateurs in the crowds in order to, you know, try to incite some type of an incident that would result in a mass shooting or killing of demonstrators or something like that. And I'm not casting this in a way to make it seem that, oh, you know, that's a far out, way out idea, that's preposterous, because personally I don't think it is. But I do think that maybe we do ourselves a disservice when we talk ahead of ourselves, since nothing like that has really happened in the United States. We might have frightened people with all that kind of conversation to the point that they're just paralyzed. Like I said, we have seen some demonstrations, and, you know, I thank God for every one of them. I hope the Palestinian people know that people here in the United States, there are so many people here who love them and support them and who have gone out into the streets in defense of their right to self-defense and defense of their right to resist, you know, just embracing them and trying to move them forward with our energy, with our love, you know, with all of that. But like I said before, they haven't been the kind of demonstrations that we had prior to the Iraq War, which were probably only outdone by protests that we had protesting the Vietnam War. I don't know. I would have to look at the stats, but I think that probably the only demonstrations we've ever had in the United States that were larger than the demonstrations in opposition to the Iraq War were the demonstrations held here in the United States in opposition to the Vietnam War. Now, here's something interesting, too, that we might think about is that as large as those demonstrations were, they didn't stop the invasion and bombing of Iraq in 2003. Our government just simply ignored them and went right ahead and did whatever it was that they had already planned to do. So I think that also registered with people in this country that, you know, our demonstrations and our free speech has kind of been made completely irrelevant because we no longer have a representative government in the United States. They don't care. You know, we could all be out in the street hollering and screaming in opposition to something, and they still do pretty much whatever it is, you know, that they want to do. So I'm sure that people, when they are calculating the risk and benefits of any type of a public action, that they are asking themselves, can we really ask people to come out and take any type of a risk when we know that what we're doing is pretty much only to satisfy our own desire to do something, but probably really will not have any effect on anything because we no longer have a representative government. You know, we have presidential candidates that go to campaign for the presidency of the United States in Tel Aviv. That's how bad things are in the United States. I posted a video today on my wall on Facebook that showed all of the presidential candidates, you know, voicing fealty to Jews. They didn't even, you know, they weren't even saying Israel. They were saying Jews, how much they love Jews and how many Jews they'll have in their cabinet if they're elected and the best friend in the world. I mean, such obvious pandering to one small minority religious group in the United States. And you think about that, and you think about the fact that absolutely no one is opposing any of that pandering based on a group of people's religion. The United States doesn't or isn't supposed to have an established religion or ideology. But we see that our government is taking steps always, it seems, to advance an ideology. And I guess our new ideology or our new religion is we're Jewish and we're Zionist here in the United States. And, you know, I say that sadly. But when you've got your presidential candidates acting like whores all over, you know, Israel, pandering and begging for money, because they know, too, that most of those Israelis are dual citizens, so they'll not only vote in the elections over in Israel, they'll come home and they'll vote in the elections over here. And they not only contribute their money, you know, in Israel, they will also contribute to candidates here in the United States that will make life easier for the people in Israel and make it hellish for the Palestinian people. So I'm sure I'm not the only person, you know, who thinks this kind of thing out and then might come to the conclusion and say, well, here in the United States, you know, it might really be a waste of time and the risk might be greater than the benefit. And that might be the cause of, you know, a lot of the lack of action or solidarity. Open, demonstrable solidarity that we see here in the United States. But, you know, don't think that's my last word on that, because I'm going to talk about some things that we can do to change all that. But first, I want to talk about the things that I think are inhibiting things. So anyway, number one on my list was I have laws banning pro-Palestinian activism. We see that a lot in France. They've banned demonstrations, pro-Palestinian demonstrations. I think they have kind of criminalized any criticism of Israel. They've criminalized participating in BDS. That's what I'm thinking. If I'm wrong, you know, somebody call me and get me straight on that. But we see a lot of laws have been passed in places like France that make it almost impossible for activists to mount large demonstrations, to speak out, to say the kind of things that need to be said in respect to the Palestinian Intifada. So because a lot of the governments, particularly in Europe, whereas in the United States, our government doesn't say, oh, you know, this is against the law and this, because we have a constitution that prohibits them from doing anything like that. But again, they know the kind of other steps they take to chill that. And they've been pretty good at that. But in Europe, they actually are passing laws to prohibit criticism of Israel, prohibit pro-Palestinian demonstrations. And I'm sure that that is really having a big effect on activists in Europe who feel like, well, if we can't do that, then what else is it that we could do to show our support and our solidarity? I think another thing that is inhibiting people is fear, simple fear. Fear of being, you know, if they speak out too loudly or too aggressively, drawing too much attention to themselves, getting involved with groups of people who are high profile or who are already been identified as pro-Palestinian or whatever, that they will also become targeted people. I had a good friend explain to me during a telephone conversation not too long ago and she worked for a government agency, and she was explaining some of the things that were frustrating her. And I said to her, well, why don't you just go upstairs and tell somebody what's going on rather than going home having, migraine headaches and throwing up and everything because you feel like you're being mistreated on your job. Isn't it just easier to get on the elevator and go upstairs and say, listen, you know, it's some stuff going on that I want to talk about because I want to keep working here. And she said to me, well, I would do that if I didn't want to lose my pension. I've worked here for like 30-something years. I'm getting ready to retire. Why would I start keeping up trouble now when I'm getting ready to retire and get my pension? And I said to her, because what's going on there is not just affecting you. It's affecting a lot of people, and it's going to keep affecting people. And when things affect you guys in your job, guess what? It affects everybody in this country because you are not happy in your job. You might not be doing it as well as you can. And that might be affecting someone who's depending on you to really do a good job. So probably important that the people upstairs understand what's going on in your department. And she said it probably is, but I'm not going to be the one to tell them. And I think that attitude is pretty pervasive in our society right now, particularly since our government seems to be very keen on allowing employers to just kick people to the curb, you know, for any reason. Now an employer can look at your Facebook page and decide that, oh, you know, we don't think you're a good fit. You shouldn't be, you know, working here. Or, well, you know, we feel threatened by your attitude and we don't, you know, think that you should be working here. Just like now potential employers can look at your credit history and decide whether or not they want you to, you know, to work for them. So we have this kind of cultural change here in the United States that has put a lot more at stake for people who want to speak out, to tell the truth, to change things than we had previously. At one point, those kind of people might have been patted on the back and called, you know, heroes. Now they're called troublemakers and they are punished. And my friend was letting me know that one of the ways they punish you, particularly if it's you're close to retirement, is they kick you out, and they kick you out in such a way that a lot of your benefits and things are not going to be available to you. So I think that we're dealing with a lot of, you know, just basic raw fear. There's really no other way to describe it or to explain it. People are just simply, afraid to be notice to say anything that would attract any attention to them, to reveal their political or religious sentiment. People are isolating themselves in that way, you know, intellectually, religiously, politically, because they don't want to be punished for their views. I don't know how many of you know, I think it was the American Psychiatric Association that recently issued a decision saying that people who challenge authority are mentally ill, that people who, challenging authority and nonconformity are mental illnesses now, according to the American Psychiatric Association. And I'm pretty sure that to issue that statement, and the only reason I'm doubting a little bit that it might have been them is because I remember in the headline I might have seen the word psychologist, that it may have been a group of psychologists who issued this statement. I would have to go back and verify that. But anyway, it's enough to know that we have this train of thought going through our professional agencies here, the agencies, you know, that show up at the congressional hearings, that are in the dark, smoke-filled rooms, when the domestic policies are being scripted, that are now telling our government as experts that, oh, well, we think people who challenge authority and who won't conform, that they have a mental illness. Now, what goes along with that? That opens the door to a whole nightmare scenario. For people who there's nothing wrong with them except that they've made a moral judgment or some other type of judgment and decided you know, I live in a free country and I don't like that and I don't want to do that and I don't believe that and I'm not afraid or ashamed to tell you that I don't agree with that. Well, you know, in the past people would have said, well, that's your right, but right now our psychiatric experts are saying, well, that's a sign of mental illness. I remember reading, too, a couple of weeks ago that taking a selfie, somebody out of these expert psychiatric groups said taking selfies is a sign of narcissism and some type of personality disorder and mental illness. So, you know, that kind of gives you an idea of what is creating and stoking, you know, some of the fear in our society here in the United States. And I'm sure if this is happening in the United States, there are probably currents of this, you know, outside of the United States. And that people simply, when they make the risk calculation again, they're saying, yeah, I really support the Intifada. I really agree with what the Palestinian people are doing. I really hope that they are going to be successful and that the illegal occupation is going to end. But I'm not really that interested in saying anything or getting involved in anything to try to make that happen because I don't want to, you know, lose my job. I don't want to lose my opportunities for lucrative employment. I don't want my children harassed and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, people, they watch the news, and I'm sure lots of people pray for the people in Palestine. But, you know, it's going to take really more than that, and I'm going to talk about that too. And then the other thing is just number three on my list was just that people don't know how. They don't know what to do. If you don't have a big organization or something that you're a part of that sends you an action alert that says, we're going to convene so-and-so corner on so-and-so, so-and-so, and burn Netanyahu in effigy, then you don't really know, you know, where to go or what you can do. And a lot of people are just not that assertive that they will just go someplace and say, you know, I want to get involved with an organization that might be willing to do or say something in support of the Intifada in Palestine, or go to an organization and say, why aren't you doing, you know, more to show solidarity with the Intifada in Palestine? You know, if you're not one of those people, or we don't have a lot of those types of people, then we will have a lot of people who want to do something, but they won't do anything because they simply don't know how, and they're not initiators. And unfortunately, the big organizations are pretty much silent on the Intifada. Even the big Muslim organizations, you don't hear them saying very much about the Palestinian Intifada. Even the Arab organizations, you're not hearing them saying a lot about the Palestinian Intifada. How many times have you turned on CNN or Fox News or 60 Minutes or any of these news programs and seen anyone there talking about what's going on in Palestine? You don't. I mean, you can get them to go, you know, grab the usual suspects and interview them on CNN, give them 10 seconds on Fox News to say something that the host can tear them to pieces on, like, you know, well, why are all Muslims terrorists or something ridiculous like that? But you don't see them grabbing anybody to pull them to the microphone to talk about what's going on in Palestine and the Palestinian Intifada. And so because we don't have our thought leaders and our big major Muslim and Arab organizations really doing what I think is as much as they can do to, you know, in support of the Intifada, then I think that's another reason we don't have more people, even non-Muslim and non-Arab people, who are self-initiating actions to show, you know, their solidarity. So that is number three. And then number four on my list is simple apathy. And I think that I have touched on that with all of these, except maybe number one, the laws, whether you're apathetic or not apathetic. It's very hard to get around the laws that make it illegal for you to protest, make it illegal for you to criticize Israel, make it illegal for you to support BDS, to openly support BDS. So in that respect, we couldn't say that's the result of apathy. But I think that for the other ones, apathy, is involved in there, in all of them, in some capacity that people have just given up because they don't see where, you know, anything that they've said or done or anything that anyone else has said or done really makes a difference. And I'm sure that that idea is reinforced when they look at the news and they see, oh, two Palestinians killed for attempting a knifing attack against, you know, an Israeli occupation soldier. And they look and say, well, okay, how does that work out? One soldier got stabbed in the arm and two Palestinians are dead. Do I support that? Well, if you look at it that way, you won't. And if you start to think about, oh, my God, look at all of the weapons that Israel has, even nuclear weapons, and the Palestinians are there with these little knives and throwing stones. You know, that can create apathy in people because it makes them feel like they're not going to end the occupation and they're not going to get free. And this is just too bloody to watch. And, you know, they stick their head under their pillow or they turn off the TV or they get off the computer and they shake their head and they say, well, I wish the best for them, but I don't, you know, think it's going to turn out anything. Israel's just going to take over all of Palestine, and that's going to be the end of it. That's a type of apathy, you know, where you just give up, where you look out and you say, well, there's nothing I can do that will make a difference, and so I'm not going to do anything, and I don't care. Because not caring is like, you know, an anesthetic. If you can say you don't care and shut your heart off to something, then there's nothing to compel you to act. If you look at it and say, huh, you know, I don't care. That's just too much for me, and I don't care. Then we start telling the heart, separate from that, close off from that. We start telling the eyes, you know, don't look at that. We start disassociating ourselves from the reality of that because, you know, for a lot of people it's too frustrating and it's too painful because they don't see an end game that suits their desire for what they would like to see. And so they feel like, well, I'm just not going to do anything and I'm not going to know about it. I'm not going to listen about it. I'm not going to watch it. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to be involved. So, you know, that's a problem. And I think that we have a lot of that in respect to the Palestine issue and also because the occupation and the killing and the massacres and the atrocities have just gone on for so long. And Israel has been granted so much impunity that even we unknowingly sometimes grant Israel impunity because we just, you know, that's the habit. That's what the world does. And so because that's what the world does, we just do it like a knee-jerk, you know, reaction to anything, to everything. I mean, every day Israel is killing young Palestinian people, and the other day they killed a young man and stripped him butt naked in the street. They're keeping the bodies. They're killing Palestinian young men, and they're keeping their bodies and refusing to return them to their parents. And they acknowledge that they're stealing, illegally harvesting the organs from those bodies. Just today, you know, an Israeli was captured in Turkey who was smuggling organs stolen out of Palestinian corpses. Now, you think about that, and if you think of that in respect to, like, what if that was a Jewish child or Jewish people? Or what if that was white people? What if that was black people in the United States? What if that was any other people? You know, other than African people, they would tolerate that for African people. Boko Haram went into a Nigerian village and slaughtered everybody in the village and set it on fire. And it wasn't even in the mainstream media. You couldn't find that story if you didn't find it in the alternative media on the internet. And maybe 3 or 4 times, 10 times the people were killed there that were killed in Paris, and not a single world leader went there and marched or mourned the lives of those people that were killed in Nigeria. So I won't say what if they were African people, because we know if they were African people, people would care even less than they do about the Palestinian people. But anyway, just take a second and think about that, that they're killing young Palestinian people, that they're taking their bodies, they're harvesting the organs illegally from their bodies, and they're refusing to give the bodies back to the family. And they are trafficking and selling the organs. That is beyond comprehension. But you don't hear a sound. You don't hear a sound. You don't hear anyone saying to Israel, release those bodies, killing those kids for throwing stones. You stop killing them even for knifing, because their knifing attacks are not killing people. Listen, Israelis killed more Israelis with knife attacks than Palestinians have, and they killed them thinking that they were killing Palestinians. And nobody's talking about that either. Or the fact that a lot of these kids are not carrying out knife attacks. They're being assassinated, and then Israel is dropping the knife or putting the knife in their hand. I mean, we had a video come out last week where Israel supposedly was showing a Palestinian attacking an Israeli soldier, and there was no Palestinian attacking anybody. It showed him hitting him in the back with his hand like he had a knife. He didn't rip his uniform, didn't put a hole in it, not one drop of blood, nothing. But it was just enough to make anyone who would look at that video, you know, casually and not critically, would say, oh my God, look, there's a Palestinian stabbing an Israeli, and how horrible that looks. And yes, they're all terrorists, and the Israelis have a right to self-defense. That's what Israel thought was going to happen. But what happened instead was people looked at it and said, well, how is he being stabbed and he's not bleeding? There's no rips or tears or anything in his clothes. He's not falling down. He's not screaming. He's not dying. So it's understandable if people feel like, you know, what can we do? Well, it's 3:42 and I've only got a few minutes left. So let's talk about some things, you know, that we can do. I think probably one of the biggest challenges that we have once we decide, and I guess the first step is that we have to decide that none of these things that I have discussed up to this point should stop us. That when we understand what's really at stake in Palestine right now and the opportunity this intifada has to do some things that will change lots of ugly things that are happening in this world, then we would understand that we have to support this intifada, that we have to get behind the people of Palestine, that we have to support them and their freedom in any way that we can, because anyone who follows that situation and anyone who has looked at how the Palestinian issue impacts everything that is going on in the world right now, domestic policies, foreign policies, economic policies, then we know that a victory for Palestine, ending the occupation in Palestine, pushing Israel out of the West Bank and containing Israel's expansion are so important strategically for the whole world. Those objectives are so important. And unfortunately, we can't put troops on the ground in Israel. Israel has a captive, you know, the world, Europe and the United States created them, a captive pen of, you know, full of people to kill and destroy and ethnically cleanse and wipe out, and then granted them, you know, impunity, and then gave them all of the weapons and everything they needed to get that job done. And unfortunately, they've allowed Israel to seal off Gaza and the West Bank and Jerusalem, the average person just, you know, you can't get there. And no one is saying, if you don't stop killing those people, we're going to send, you know, troops in there to stop the IOF from killing innocent Palestinians in here. Nobody is threatening that. Nobody is even saying to Israel, if you don't stop, we're going to sanction you. Nobody is saying that. Matter of fact, I think somebody issued a statement last week that said, or maybe it was the week before that, that said, the United States supports Israel's right to self-defense. Well, who in the hell is Israel defending themselves from? Have you ever seen, and you think about this, initiate out of the clear blue sky during a period of absolute calm, initiate any armed assault or attack on Israel or any settlers or anything? No, you won't find one. Zero. The Palestinians never initiate these series and these rounds of, you know, Israeli bloodletting in Palestine. The Palestinians never initiate them. They respond when it gets to the point where they have no choice except to do something in their own defense. They never do anything at all. Not in an armed sort of way, an aggressive, you know, or militarized sort of way. They don't. Israel always provokes and Israel always initiates. But still, we have people here in the United States that says they have a right to self-defense. Well, they don't have a right to self-defense in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip. They don't have a right to self-defense, in my opinion, anywhere in Palestine. But they don't even have an argument for a right to self-defense, you know, in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and Jerusalem and all of that. They don't. They just simply don't. And the law says that they don't. And even the Supreme Court of the United States just, you know, said that Jerusalem is not Israel. Israel has no rights there. It has no right on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. It has no right to have soldiers there. It has no right to be controlling that. It has no right to be prohibiting Muslims from going to the mosque and telling them how old they have to be to go and when they can go and who can. They have no right. It's only happening because there's no one to stop them. Because the same people who were willing to send troops into Syria to get rid of Assad because they said he's a criminal, terrible dictator who's oppressing his people, won't do a damn thing about Netanyahu, who is overtly killing, slaughtering, penning people in concentration camps, prisons, torturing, everything. But not one of these governments, you know, would send an armed militia into Israel or into Palestine to confront the IOF and say, you must, you know, stop that or answer to us. But they pretend that they love the people of Syria so much, they love the people of the Ukraine and Crimea so much that they have to send, put boots on the ground to save them, you know, from the terrible dictator. Well, how about saving the Palestinian people from Mahmoud Abbas? That would make a big difference in and of itself. That's another program. That's next week's program. We're going to talk about Mahmoud Abbas and how we're going to get him to either resign or be impeached, inshallah. Stay tuned for that one. But anyway, back to some of the things that we can do. We have to decide, first of all, that we're going to do something. We have to decide that in spite of all of the odds, in spite of everything that says why do anything, that we shouldn't do anything, we have to decide, no, we must do something. And if you can't decide that based on your love and support simply for the Palestinian people as fellow human beings, think about how what's going on there is impacting the entire world and everything that is going on in Paris, in Syria, in Iraq, in Turkey, everywhere, in Russia, threat that's posed to Russia, all of that, that everybody seems to have a real good understanding of, and that the root of all of that is right there in Tel Aviv. And that if the Palestinian people are able to contain and cause Israel to withdraw, not only militarily, but also the settlers, to stop construction of illegal settlements, all of that has a tremendous impact on everything that is taking place in the Arab Muslim world. And if you don't believe me, consider this. Israel was pushing again to expand, to build more settlements, to announce the building of more settlements, more confiscation of land, and was getting a negative response from the Palestinians, who were saying, well, we're going to pull out of negotiations, we're going to end the peace process, blah, 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 blah. Up pops arch-Zionist Daniel Pipes to issue a statement advising Israel, saying, okay, well, you can't fight on two fronts. So if you're not making any progress in Palestine, turn all of your attention toward Syria. That went right over everybody's head. It was the first time that anyone admitted that Israel had an interest in Syria. And this was long before the UN and everybody came out and said Israel and Daesh are connected, they're working together, that it's all one. Long before that, this has to have been 3 or 4 years ago when Daniel Pipes issued that advice to Israel, saying to them, don't try and fight on two fronts. If you're not making any progress in Palestine, then direct all of your attention towards Syria. And if you can't make, you know, any progress in Syria, if you don't feel like it's worth it, then focus more in Palestine. But you can't fight on two fronts. I mean, what greater admission could there be that Israel is pushing all of this settlement building, all of this pushing into Syria, all of this desperation to get the land cleared and the way cleared and the people cleared out of their Greater Israel project? What else do we need to understand and to know that we must support the Palestinian people? We have no choice, because they've already told us what they plan to do with us. You don't remember the grand poobah of Judaism sitting in Israel saying that we were all created to serve them? That the only purpose of our even existing is to serve them? Now, if you want to see where that takes you, imagine a human being who feels that it's okay for them to take your child's dead body and strip it of its organs and sell the organs and not even offer you any of the money, not even get your permission, and not even give you your child's body back. That should kind of tell us all what they think about us. Now, people will say, oh, that's just how they feel about the Palestinians, because they hate Arabs and they hate Muslims. And no. Carrying out similar and worse atrocities than that all over the world, they're just not doing it under the flag and the Star of David. I mean, when we look at Daesh, you know, ISIS, whatever you want to call it, that's Israel. And when you look in that Old Testament and you read what they call the terrorism verses, this one Christian called them the terrorist verses of the Bible that the fundamentalists are adopting in order to justify, you know, violence. He was talking about condemning Christians for anti-Semitism. And he actually missed the point that, you're talking about the Old Testament, and that's talking about Jews killing Gentiles, Jews conquering Gentile villages and killing everything breathing, you know, and burning up, you know, everything that's left behind. So I don't know how he was using those verses to condemn anti-Semitism when actually they were anti-Gentilism. But anyway, that's another program. I'm noting this down. We're going to have a program about that too. But anyway, back to my point. We have no choice except to put our support behind the Palestinians and to make this intifada successful. This is the first intifada where the Palestinian people have said, this intifada is about freedom and ending this occupation. It's not about just lifting the siege on Gaza. It's not about just ending settlement building. It's not about just giving the bodies back of the people Israel is killing. It's not about any one of those things. Now it's all of those things. This intifada is about ending the illegal occupation of Palestine, taming Israel, putting them on a leash, denying them their expansion, saying that you will not be allowed to go beyond your mandated territory. You will not expand. That's what Russia is saying right now in Syria. That's what the people of Iraq are saying right now in Iraq. That's what the people in Crimea and all these places in Ukraine were saying. No, there will be no greater Israel. But listen, the place to fight them, of course, you have to fight them in all those places. And when you fight ISIS and Daesh, that's what you're doing. I don't care whether anybody likes me saying that or not. But there's no more important fight going on right now than that fight right there in Palestine. And I give you another reason why. Because there is billions of dollars worth of gold and oil and natural gas there that Israel desperately wants. And if they get their hands on it, there is no containing or controlling or coexisting with Israel. We're done. Okay? So we have got to stand with the Palestinian people, and we have to help them in any way that we can. If we don't think that marching and demonstrations are going to make any difference, then we have to find who are the public officials who can make a difference, and we have to start to pressure them to make a difference. We have to start to cleanse our government of these Zionist policymakers and people who are advancing the Zionist ideology and agenda and who are supporting and serving Israel through our taxpayer-funded institutions. We need to vote them out, force them out, get them out, any way that we can. We need to cut off Israel's impact in our government and in our public services and public offices, our law enforcement. We need to stand up strongly against our law enforcement being trained over in Israel. If for no other reason, cut off the money that's associated with that so that Israel cannot get it. And I'm surprised that BDS hasn't already seen the strategic importance of putting that on BDS. We have to, as taxpayers in the United States and possibly in Europe, also consider tax revolts, refusing to allow our tax money to be used to fund and continue to fund Israel. But before we get to that point, how about lawsuits? How about going to court and getting injunctions and denying the United States the ability to continue to send billions of dollars to Israel and allowing Israel to use U.S. weaponry against the Palestinian people? Why not go to court and put this occupation on trial? We've got enough lawyers here in the United States, and there are enough of them in Europe that it could happen anywhere. We just had a judge in Spain who said, if Netanyahu comes to Spain, he's going to be arrested. Don't we have one judge in the United States or Europe that's willing to say anybody who is selling weapons to Israel or giving aid to Israel, as long as they're outside of their mandated border, as long as they're building Israeli settlements, as long as they're carrying out these extrajudicial executions, sanction them. And if you can't sanction them through policy, take them to court and get injunctions. There are a million unexplored ways and opportunities that we can fight this thing. The street is the least effective right now, for whatever reason you attribute that to. But there are more potent and more important, strategically important ways to support the Palestinian Intifada. And the interesting thing about it is you can do this without being high profile, without people really even knowing who you are. You can contribute to organizations and to people, help pay lawyers, come together and think about any ways that we can do things that help us to overcome these 3 to 4 things that I've listed, and it's 3:59. Now I've got 1 minute left. So, you know, we can overcome the laws. The law says we can't publicly criticize, we can't demonstrate, but we can sue the hell out of them. We can find the laws, all the human rights laws, everything we can to deny Israel money and funding from the EU and the U.S. there are a million ways to stand that. So anyway, I have to wrap this up now. I've got 10 seconds left. For everybody who joined me this afternoon, I want to thank you. We're going to come back next Saturday at the same time, inshallah. We're going to talk about Mahmoud Abbas and the PA because they are a big impediment and barrier to Palestinian liberation. And I don't have time to explain, you know, my take on all that right now. So we're going to talk about it next Saturday at 3 o'clock. I hope you'll join me. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.